健康、时尚、美食、出行，尽在衣食住行。
每周五晚9:30，请锁定 AM1150西雅图中文电台。
Good afternoon. My name is Meng Wang. I'm director with the Washington State China Relations Council. Thank you for joining us today for a discussion on China's digital ambitions. And today's program is co-hosted by the National Bureau of Asian Research, NBR, and the Washington State China Relations Council, WCRC. And the discussion will be based on a report recently released by the NBR titled China's Digital Ambitions, a Global Strategy to Supplant the Liberal Order. And the report examines China's strategic approach to the digital revolution, assesses the implication for the international order, and provides a roadmap for a multilateral response by the United States and its allies and partners. And in fact, this program was originally scheduled in April, but we had to postpone it due to a speaker's family emergency. Now we are excited to have a new panel of three experts to discuss the same topic. Our speakers include Nigel Query from the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, Allison Zalwinski, and Jock Strapp from NBR. Our moderator will introduce the speakers in more details in a little bit. I believe most of you are familiar with NBR at the WCRC, but just in case, let me briefly introduce both organizations. The National Bureau of Asian Research is an independent, nonprofit, nonpartisan research institution based in Seattle and Washington, D.C. that brings world-class scholarship to bear on the evolving strategic environment in Asia through original policy-relevant research and dialogue. NBR's work is conducted by a global network of over 4,000 experts who brings to bear a broad range of disciplines, professions, and regional and topical focuses. Today's program features NBR's Center for Innovation, Trade, and Strategy, which researches topics including China's digital strategy, digital trade and data governance in the Indo-Pacific, U.S. economic and trade strategy, supply chain security, and international property. As for our organization, the WCRC, we were founded in 1979 and is the oldest state-level nonprofit organization promoting trade, commercial, educational, and cultural exchanges between U.S. and China. In early 2020, we established a 501c sister organization, the Washington State China Relations Fund, to support our educational programs and local community efforts. Let me briefly introduce our moderator today, Nora Cochiard, Executive Director at the WCRC. Nora spent 35 years living and working in Asia before moving back to the U.S. in 2016. During his 18 years in Shanghai, Nora served as the China president for Cargill and as the chairman of the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai in 2008 and 2009. Nora also provided leadership to several international nonprofit organizations, as well as CEO leadership groups. Before I turn the program over to Nora, allow me to go over some housekeeping items. Please make sure to stay muted throughout the session. If you have questions for the speakers, please type them in the chat box, and we'll collect and raise them to the speakers during the audience Q&A session. Please note that this discussion is being recorded and will be posted on our YouTube channel. I'll post our channel's link in the chat box momentarily. You can also find some of our past event recordings there. And lastly, I'd also like to bring your attention to our upcoming events. This Thursday, we'll have two expats living in Shanghai to talk about lives in the city after the partial reopening. This is a sequel to our webinar in early May on the life under lockdown in Shanghai. So we're actually going to invite back the same speakers for the May event. It's going to be a very interesting and insightful discussion. On July 13th, we'll talk with a former WeChat executive on his new book, The First Super App, Inside China's WeChat and the New Digital Revolution. I'll post the event links in the chat box, so hope you can join us. And Nor, over to you.
Okay, thanks, Meng, and welcome to all our participants. I'll briefly outline our program right now, and then we'll get started. First, I'm going to introduce our speaker, and our first speaker is going to be Allison Zalwinski, who's going to briefly introduce NBR's report about China's digital ambitions. She'll explain the reasons behind the report and its methodology, and then make some comments about trends in the Indo-Pacific and how China's digital strategy fits into changes taking place in the region. After that, Doug will provide us with a summary of the key findings of the report. And once Doug finishes, Nigel Corey, the Associate Director of Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, will make some remarks about particular sections of the report that he worked on. And then before we start the Q&A sessions, I'll ask Allison to give us some of the reactions and feedback about the report, because NBR has had sessions like this in both Europe and Asia prior to today. Then we'll have a little moderated Q&A followed by audience Q&A. As mentioned by Mon, please type your questions in the chat box. Again, we'll try our best to get to all of them. We'll see how the session goes. So now to quickly introduce our speakers. Nigel Corey, who's, again, the Associate Director of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, works on cross-border data flows, data governance, intellectual property, and how they relate to digital trade in the broader economy. He's published a number of reports and op-eds relating to these issues in the U.S., Europe, Australia, China, India, New Zealand, and other countries. He's also completed research projects for international bodies such as the Asia-Pacific Cooperation and the World Trade Organization. And prior to his work with NBR, well, in his previous life, Nigel worked for 8 years in Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Our next speaker is Doug Strub, who's the Assistant Director, Center for Innovation and Trade at NBR. Doug manages and supports research on projects focusing on Asian economies, trade, innovation, and intellectual property policy issues with a focus on China. Prior to joining NBR, he spent 5 years in China working for the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai, writing reports for the World Bank in Beijing, and studying Mandarin in Guilin and in Wuhan. And finally, Allison Swalinski is the Vice President of Research at NBR, and Allison provides executive leadership to NBR's policy research agenda and oversees research teams in both Seattle and Washington, D.C. She's the author of numerous articles and reports and is the co-editor of NBR's Strategic Asia series. Prior to joining NBR, Allison spent time at the U.S. Department of State and at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Her research interests include U.S. alliance relationships, U.S.-China relations, and the implications of great power competition for U.S. alliances in the region. So now I'm going to ask Allison to provide us a little bit of background about why NBR conducted this study and produced this report. So Allison, please.
Great. Thanks so much, Noor. And I want to extend a thanks as well to WSCRC for having us to speak on this topic and on this project that we undertook. So as the digital world becomes increasingly important, especially in the rapidly digitizing economies and societies of the Indo-Pacific, the ability to influence and shape digital environments is going to be increasingly important to the overall landscape. So with this in mind, NBR recently undertook over the past, it's been about a year since we began, a major initiative to understand what China's digital strategy is and how that manifests across all different elements of the digital domain. Now, there have been some other research initiatives that have tried to examine China's strategy, but they haven't connected it to how it actually plays out both in the physical and virtual worlds. And there are also projects that examine one line of China's efforts in detail, but don't make connections across domains. So we wanted this research to provide a more complete picture of the whole scope of China's efforts. And to do that, we brought together a really stellar project team of experts that could examine these issues. Now, the analysis that these experts conducted concluded that the CCP has identified a window of strategic opportunity to shift the global digital balance of power in its favor. And it's going to use this window to challenge the existing liberal order. There are also close connections between Chinese efforts in the digital domain and other domains in which China is seeking to reshape global rules. Now, our research highlights a number of security implications of China's digital strategy, which could have not only adverse military effects, but also pose threats to the economic security of the United States and our partners. More fundamentally, on the economic side, several Chinese economic practices have malign effects, from subsidies for its digital firms that enable them to dominate global supply chains and markets, to IP theft and forced tech transfer, to predatory loans. These strategies will enable the CCP and its digital firms to profit from challenging the existing liberal order. And then politically, China's efforts are not just giving them bilateral leverage over countries, but are also increasing their influence over multilateral institutions like the ITU, a UN standard-setting body. The way in which China is using this influence, which is often laundered through nominally private firms or individual actors, to advance its strategic aims undermines the cooperative foundations of the post-war international system and the benefits that this atmosphere of open international cooperation has created. So it's very clear that this is going to be an ongoing contest that will take place across a variety of domains. And we're hopeful that our project will contribute to the discussion on these topics. So for some additional details on the project, the issues that we dived into, and some of the key takeaways, I'll turn it over to my colleague at MDR, Assistant Director for the Trade Center, Doug Stroop.
Oh, thanks, Allison. Doug, please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Ali, and thank you, Noor and Nan, and WSCRC for hosting this event. We're all excited to be here and discuss these topics. So as Ali mentioned, this project sought to examine China's global digital strategy basically across all domains and link them together into one comprehensive and cohesive strategy. And just a little more on the project. So we brought together six experts, as she mentioned, and we authored a 7-chapter report examining what the strategy is and how this strategy is being executed around the world. And then this was accompanied by an online interactive data tool that allows users to explore and compare a wide range of variables related to China's growing digital influence around the world. And I believe my colleague Jonathan will drop a link to that tool in the chat if anyone wants to check it out. It's pretty interesting. And then as Noor hinted at, we traveled to Europe in person for some public and private briefings, and then did virtual events with Tokyo, Seoul, and Taipei. A large part of this project was seeking to engage with non-American audiences and both share our findings and learn from them. So Allison will return in a little while to share a bit more about that. But getting into the project's findings, the core argument, which Ali had touched upon, is that Chinese leaders have diagnosed that that data is a new factor of production and that this is catalyzing a new industrial revolution. And Beijing is seeking to capitalize on this and the rapid digitalization and technological change taking place across the world to increase not only its influence over the evolving global digital architecture, but to increase its national power across all domains, including economic and military. And they really view this as an opportunity to reshuffle the balance of power and leapfrog to leadership of the international system. And this is based on an examination of past industrial revolutions that have allowed sort of countries that are maybe not the dominant power, but who gain dominance in an emerging technology to similarly leapfrog and rapidly advance their national power. So we really saw this as the end game of China's digital strategy, is that it seeks to reshape the international system to be more reflective of Chinese values and norms and to advantage Beijing. And by doing so, to lock in asymmetric advantage for itself. So to achieve this, Beijing is seeking to increase its access to and control over global information flows, which is to say its control over international data, its movement, and by extension, the production, distribution, and consumption of resources and ideas internationally, as data is essentially driving so many interactions across the world today. And doing this will advantage China politically by granting Beijing the ability to shape narratives through the use of disinformation, propaganda, and censorship, economically by shaping the digital ecosystem to favor Chinese digital platforms, products, and services, and militarily by granting Beijing an asymmetric information advantage over adversaries or potential adversaries. So in sum, Beijing seeks to control the data defining land, air, and sea movement of people and things, military and commercial. They also seek to, at any point and with little cost, threaten an adversary's ability to see, talk, or move. And the consequences of this would be immense. So to capture the comprehensive nature of China's digital strategy and how it's being executed, this research initiative examined how Beijing is carrying out the strategy from both the bottom up and the top down. So from the bottom up, we began by looking at the construction of physical digital infrastructure and particularly China's role in building this infrastructure abroad. And a lot of this is carried out, obviously, through the Belt and Road and Digital Silk Road. And this is really a core component of China's digital strategy as it builds inroads for Beijing and Chinese companies in newly digitizing and emerging markets. It also establishes digital facts on the ground, especially the creation of de facto technical standards. And then it also often carries with it Chinese digital norms and rules. You could see this, for example, countries where China is building the infrastructure and then sort of pushing or supporting the use of its digital platforms. You could use WeChat as an example for maybe financial payments, and then this gets adopted more and more, and that as more people use it, that grants Beijing or the Chinese government to better shape the information environment by controlling what's available on WeChat. That's just an example. And then we looked at this also from the top down, from the Chinese government's efforts in international organizations through bilateral and multilateral agreements, and even through private sector engagement. And that includes, for the international organizations, Chinese involvement in international standard setting organizations, and all of these efforts, which Nigel will talk more about, work to shape digital norms and rules from the top down. And these sort of bottom-up and top-down efforts are mutually reinforcing and advance the Chinese government's objectives. We also found in our research that China is uniquely positioned to succeed in achieving its digital ambitions, as it benefits from a number of asymmetric advantages, including size, scale, and centralization. The size is quite obvious with China's population and the size of its digital user base. This produces enormous amounts of data, which is a valuable resource for further digital development and innovation, especially including machine learning and AI. And while collecting data is very valuable on its own, even more significant value is derived from controlling the exchange of data. And here is where the scale of Chinese networks is unique. China's unmatched industrial capacity enables its companies to engage in activities, including the aforementioned construction of digital infrastructure abroad at an unrivaled scale, essentially enlarging their networks and their control over networks, which grants Beijing greater influence over the associated data flows. And then the centralized state-driven, state-directed nature of this strategy ensures that all the components of the strategy are working together toward the same objectives. And then lastly on that, China's asymmetric integration with the world has also provided numerous advantages, including the ability to access other countries' data while protecting its own and providing a protected domestic environment for its own tech companies to develop sort of with reduced competition, while letting those same companies benefit from the open access to information abroad. And then towards the end of the report, we look at some of the security challenges from this, and particularly the author of that chapter focused on the redefinition of the battlefield of competition, or redefining this by using the commercial sector. And he focused a lot on Beijing's use of the commercial sector to achieve state goals, or state objectives, which ties back to those asymmetric advantages. And then the report concludes with a chapter about recommendations, and it finds that China's digital strategy has made significant progress, but like-minded partners pursuing open liberal digital values still have the ability to be the dominant force in shaping the digital domain and protecting the global rules-based system. But this will require more committed policy responses and greater cross-border coordination. So I don't want to go through all the recommendations, but essentially the core of it is to strengthen and modernize the existing liberal system for the digital era. And that includes creating new rules that reinforce liberal and democratic norms in the digital domain, and a lot greater cooperation and alignment of data policies among like-minded countries. And then another sort of core theme of the recommendations is to offer more and better alternatives than those being provided by China. You see a lot in these Belt and Road countries that want to digitize. If China's the only option, of course, they're going to take it. So rather than trying to constrain China's behavior, we need to offer more alternative options that can better compete with China in that regard. So in closing, conversations about China's digital presence and the threat it presents tend to focus on tactical dangers like surveillance, espionage, and cybersecurity. But we found that these conversations ignore the more foundational strategic contest for the global digital architecture. And that if China succeeds in becoming the dominant force in the global digital system, Beijing will lock in control over the information environment and shape it to align with the CCP's broader strategic ambitions and values. And if successful, the CCP would be able to not just gather information on individuals, companies, and countries' activities, but also to shape the information environment that defines these activities. I'm happy to talk about any of that more in the Q&A, but I'm going to turn it over to Nigel now.
This is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KNUC 98.9 HD3 Seattle.
现在是美国西部时间晚上10点整。
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guest, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Chinese Radio Seattle.
声声有情
1150 AM 西雅图中文电台
这里是您的信息中心
这里是您的心灵港湾
这里是您的精神家园
西雅图华人自己的中文电台
朋友们也可以在网上收听我们的节目 收听网址是 ChineseRadioSeattle.com，
也可以通过智能手机下载 Chinese Radio Seattle 或者西雅图中文电台 App 来收听我们的节目。我们的高清调频频道是
FM 98.9 Channel
3。我们的微信平台、新浪微博和 Facebook 账号都是 Chinese Radio Seattle。
你有旅行计划吗？请记住。 RealID 法案将于 2023年5月3日 在华盛顿州生效，标准华盛顿州驾驶执照将不再适用于国内航空旅行或进出一些联邦设施。那么，这会影响你吗？这取决于您的旅行习惯和其他因素。您可能已经拥有所需的东西，但您或许可能需要获得新的身份证件，例如增强型驾驶执照或护照。想知道更多，请到ID2023wa.com/zh了解您的选择。
热烈祝贺！热烈祝贺！热烈祝贺！亚都中文地带，西雅图中文地带，西雅图中文地带，西雅图中文电台，西雅图中文电台，西雅图中文电台，开播10周年。
谁对青少年的影响比名人、社交媒体和朋友更大？可能很难相信。 但就是你自己。研究表明，当成年人参与青少年的生活时，他们使用大麻的可能性就会降低。所以你们一起看电影，一起散步，一起追赶，当你花时间和他们在一起的时候，你创造了交谈的机会。要了解更多信息，请访问 starttalkingnow.org。 记住，你是对你孩子影响力最大的人。本广告由 Washington State Department of Health 支付。
No worries. Thanks, Doug. Firstly, thanks, Nan. Thanks, Noor. And thanks to the Washington State China Relations Council for the invitation to speak today. This issue is one of many that I love. And so I was really appreciate the opportunity to do a deep dive into China's evolving approach to influence global data governance. And in summary, I'll provide a brief overview of their approach and their key sort of examples of how they've gone about prosecuting it, but I'll leave the recommendations for the Q&A if that's of interest. But basically, China's approach is nascent and evolving, but increasingly well articulated and prosecuted at the global, regional, and country level. And we've seen a real change in China over the last 5 years, from one that's been mainly internally focused about sort of building its domestic digital sort of restrictive system, to one that's also increasingly external. And so in particular, we saw this articulated by China's Global Initiative on Data Security, so-called GIDS, as a strategy that outlines their approach, which they're articulating and advocating for in various organizations and places around the world. But basically, at the heart of China's international data strategy is the principles of state and cyber sovereignty, where governments can essentially take whatever action they deem necessary. It's about control. China's new cybersecurity law, its personal information protection law, and data security law provide a comprehensive legal foundation for data governance in China and address legitimate issues in China that other countries like the United States are trying to address, but they provide no effective check on the government's ability to control data. And in analysing China, sort of a core characteristic of China's approach, it's important to highlight that data will naturally flow across borders, cross-border data flows, as a part of the global internet, absent artificial restrictions and controls, which is what China's been building for the last 20 years. China is a world leader in forcing firms to only store data locally within the country's borders, a concept known as data localization, with dozens of laws and regulations which make data transfers illegal or prohibitively complicated and costly. It does this by through specifying specific action against like personal or financial genomic data or financial insurance data, or it does it through broad categorization such as important data or strategic data. And this approach contrasts with most other countries, which allow the legal responsibility of a country's laws to travel with that data, regardless of where the data is stored. Now, what's at the heart of the battle here between China's sort of control restrictive approach and the emerging global norm elsewhere is the settings for a critical part of the internet and the global economy, which will have a huge impact on trade, on commerce and innovation, as well as a whole host of social and political impacts, given what this data represents in terms of information and sort of political sort of associated sort of efforts. But again, to Doug's point, how successful China's sort of nascent approach to engaging on these issues internationally will be depends on what the United States, United Kingdom, Australia, Japan, and others do in stepping up their own game in countering China's efforts and that advocating for alternative measures that protect the free flow of data and digital trade and data-driven innovation, as well as a free and open internet. So in terms of China's evolving approach, there are a few key examples and a few key trends, I suppose, in that China tends to favour multilateral institutions like the UN and the International Telecommunications Union as they provide voting power to governments, thus lending itself to China's focus on state sovereignty and their ability to marshal groups of countries to support their positions. It also makes it easier for China to marginalise the private sector and public advocacy groups, which they don't like having a seat at the table. And in the same way, the ITU scales even more readily than the UN as private firms, as sector members, have a seat at the table as well.
And so that allows Chinese firms to also be there at the table and to vote on important issues. China can, at these institutions, as one official put it to me, flood the zone and ensuring that it has as many participants and proposals and as many forums as possible. And so these sort of public-private death by a thousand cuts is a coordinated strategy by China to get its preferred language embedded in various agendas, discussions and documents around sort of data and digital governance. Essentially, China and Russia want to use cyber discussions at the UN and the ITU to push a broad agenda, or as one official put it to me, to engage in so-called issue creep around cybercrime and cybersecurity, but they want to push that to a broader sort of internet governance or data governance model, because those institutions are state-based, and thus it's a way that those two sort of authoritarian countries can try and design sort of the rules around data and the digital economy in a way that suits them. And so that's obviously problematic because many governance arrangements for the internet are multi-stakeholder, are open and transparent and engage in these debates around what's the best settings to maximize the benefits from the global internet. China and Russia sort of don't favor that approach. So how else does China go about this? And you see this bilaterally, regionally, by the government, but also by their firms. You see AliCloud and Tencent Cloud directly and explicitly advocating for data localization in Indonesia and in India and elsewhere in an effort to differentiate themselves from US cloud firms and others, because policymakers in these countries are uncertain about allowing sort of US cloud firms in their markets and wondering whether they will provide legal barriers to them accessing data. The Chinese firms, replicating what they do at home, have come in and said, don't worry about us, we'll keep all the data here and you won't have any issues accessing it, which is a major change in general trend to how US cloud companies and others manage it. You also see China directly advocating for ICT infrastructure in a whole host of countries, which is, I suppose, what China is best known for in terms of delivering sort of large-scale infrastructure. But as I catalogue in my report, you also see them starting to edge closer to advocating regulations around data and the digital economy associated with these projects. And you see this in Tanzania and Senegal and elsewhere, where those respective governments are considering or enacting data localization, as well as strict sort of online content regulation, content moderation and censorship arrangements there. In terms of trade and trade agreements, it's a flavour of the month still. China has not agreed to binding rules on data flows and digital trade and any trade agreement. In that, it has agreed to the e-commerce chapter of RCEP, but these are non-binding and are pretty weak, so it doesn't really represent much. China's engaged at the e-commerce negotiations at the WTO, but those talks haven't progressed enough to get to the sensitive issues around data, which will be central to the outcome. And so we're unsure sort of whether China will even be involved there or whether it'll use those talks as an opportunity to evolve in terms of how they approach these issues. But in terms of recommendations of what the US and other countries should do to counter China's approach to advocate for its top-down, state-directed approach to data and data governance in the digital economy, I'll leave that for any of the Q&A. But otherwise, I'll end it there and hand it back to Nora and Nan.
Okay, thanks, Nigel. Actually, before we get into Q&A, Ali was going to make a few comments about how this report has been received around the world through those sessions. So, Ali, do you want to share anything with us?
Yeah, I can go through just a few quick points, make sure we leave plenty of time for the Q&A. So as was mentioned earlier, following the release of the culminating report that we did, we were able to engage with a really wide group of stakeholders around the world. We held in-person events, private briefings with policymakers in Europe, in Paris and London, and we did virtual activities with Seoul, Tokyo and Taipei because of the COVID restrictions there. We're really heartened to see continued interest from governments, thought leaders, academics, media, and the general public in the international engagement and policy-relevant research that we were doing on this critical topic. Now, in Europe, we found a much higher level of awareness of an interest in China's digital strategy than in some previous interactions. And I think that's in line generally with a trend we've seen, a general shift in the way that European counterparts are thinking about China policy issues. Part of this, especially the timing we were there, is also due to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Part of it is also due to COVID and global perceptions of China following COVID. And some of it is due to other developments in Europe, including economic coercion against Lithuania, freezing of the EU-China CAI investment agreement, and other kind of economic tools and leverage that China has been applying against Europe. So we found very clear understanding that transatlantic cooperation is necessary to address the China challenge, and hopes that there can be new methods for deeper trilateral U.S., Europe, EU, and Asia cooperation. Within that, some priority areas seem to include digital infrastructure, data governance, and the EU is also interested in strengthening engagement with non-traditional partners, including developing countries where they recognize that China's strategy has been a little more successful. So in the Asia interactions that we had in East Asia, awareness of the risks associated with China's digital strategy has been around longer. So there's already a degree of agreement with the general contours of the findings that our research produced. We also found that awareness and interest in policies to push back against China's digital strategy tend to align with each country's experiences with China and their overall role in the region. So, for instance, our interlocutors in Japan were particularly interested in data governance and norms in support of their free and open Indo-Pacific concept. And Taiwan seems more concerned about finding a balance of national security and economic interests for its tech sector. Now, we did notice a number of similarities between the European and Indo-Pacific perspectives. There is strong interest across the board in pursuing deeper trilateral cooperation and putting together new mechanisms to advance that. There's also a lot of interest in what the U.S. is doing on data governance and frustration regarding Congress's ability to put together a domestic privacy framework. And finally, there's a strong understanding that we need to bring in non-traditional partners, but maybe less of an understanding that of how to do that. That came up and was especially true, for instance, in India's case, which was brought up in both regions we interacted with, where there were questions about how to handle a democracy that shares a number of values with the United States and our partners, but also pursues data localization policies that are quite aligned with what China is pushing as a central plank of its digital strategy. So I think that those areas of alignment are good news for the United States and gives us a lot of room to build off of. But there are many differences that remain regarding how to best address the challenges arising from China's growing digital influence.
Great. Thank you for that, Allison. And I think now we'll go to moderated Q&A. We only have about 20 minutes or so, so I'll keep my questions short, and then we'll go to audience questions. But there's a lot here to tackle. I guess I'd start by saying, okay, there's quite a, seeing it's a gap kind of between the West and China about the digital situation, and China's moving much faster. So what should the West be doing, and what are some of the best steps that they could take to try and counter what China's doing? And I'm not sure who to throw that question to, so please speak up.
I'm happy to take a first swing. In terms of how best to counter what China's doing, it's multifaceted, and it's challenging for the United States because it itself has not put in place some of the foundational blocks of data and digital governance, which would provide the foundation for them to advocate for a constructive, positive alternative to what China's doing in terms of pursuing a top-down, restrictive, control-orientated internet. So that makes it challenging. And so we've seen, obviously, regardless of that, I suppose we've seen the Biden administration try to sort of marshal the forces with its future of the future. I forget the acronym, the future of the internet, the future of democratic internet. The announcement from a few weeks ago, part of the reason I forgot it is because what's the best way to put it? Probably lackluster in terms of it just does not provide the type of concrete, specific, detailed action plan that outlines how the US is going to go about advocating for a constructive, positive alternative to what China's doing. It's so broad as to be lowest common denominator. But then in the same vein, like I see valiant efforts by at the agency level, by USAID, USTR, Commerce and others in their respective areas, doing very proactive, direct engagement with counterparts around the world on various data-related issues. For example, I had an email today that USAID is funding a digital trade policy advisor in Africa to work with the African Union as they think about what they want to do on data and digital. And so that's just one small example. And we've seen the US system sort of gain awareness and crank into gear over the last few years and get dedicating funding and policy attention to this issue, but it still has a long way to go.
One advisor to Africa compared to what China's doing in Africa is not going to cut it. Yeah, how about, but are there other countries? I mean, in Europe, are they,
yeah, have a strategy? And, so, and that's part of the challenge, right, is that Europe is far more involved on the ground in, say, for Africa, advocating for their preferred approach, which may not be the US's preferred approach. Mm. But because they have the General Data Protection Regulation, they have a book and they have a whole bunch of other books on other parts of digital regulation that they can sort of hand over, and that makes them a compelling partner. But they've been involved more often at more levels, more comprehensively, in places like Africa. And so, again, the US's ability to sort of advocate for its own approach is hamstrung in that way. So it's a matter with the, as Ali was saying, with the transatlantic cooperation, there are things that they can do together that they can align on, and then there's things they'll do apart, but they may not always be on the same book when they're doing it. And so therein lies the challenge of trying to get more people on the same page more often in terms of pointing out, well, this is something in our shared interest that we really don't want. We need to sort of divide and conquer on how best to counteract this.
Yeah, and at this point today, it sounds like no one's taking direct leadership on this. Yeah.
No, and that's a part of the challenge with the US administration, right? With digital policy, it's as one official put it to me, it's atomized across the agencies, and they each have their own responsibilities, and they're quite often doing a very good job in their own little space, but there's no overarching force bringing them together, figuring out how their pieces come together and then advocating for it. And so, I mean, a reflection of that to your first point, Noor, and what Alison said about the lack of a data privacy regime here is that because of that, we've seen a predominantly national security lens applied to everything China and digital, including Reuters report from a few weeks ago about a draft executive order that would target Chinese access to sensitive US data. And so you see there, lacking a data privacy bill, they're relying on national security to try and enact some sort of countermeasures. And while that may be useful in some circumstances, that's not going to cut it and not going to do what a comprehensive data privacy and protection sort of bill and strategy would do.
你有旅行计划吗？请记住Real ID 法案将于2023年5月3日在华盛顿州生效，标准华盛顿州驾驶执照将不再适用于国内航空旅行或进出一些联邦设施。那么，这会影响你吗？这取决于您的旅行习惯和其他因素。您可能已经拥有所需的东西，但您或许可能需要获得新的身份证件，例如增强型驾驶执照或护照。想知道更多，请到 ID2023WA.com/ZH 了解您的选择。
肌肉骨骼伤痛、车祸、工伤，请找康健脊椎治疗中心肖明医师。康健康健，祝您健康。电话2066217501，2066217501。
汽车广告说：实惠低月供。 听起来不错，但是经销商那儿却另有陷阱。实惠，经销商可能会捆绑其他需要额外支付的项目，例如额外的产品或服务。低月供，您可能需要付高额首付。最重要的是，如果汽车并非广告所说的价格，或其价格您无法接受，请马上转身离开。如果经销商刊登不实的汽车广告，可通过网站 reportfraud.ftc.gov 向美国消费者保护机构联邦贸易委员会举报。联邦贸易委员会或其网址宣。
And as you mentioned, China kind of has the asymmetric advantage because it's huge, lots of data, and they've got a centralized strategy. Yeah. Doug or Ali, do you want to weigh in on this before we move on?
Sure, I can just offer a few quick thoughts from the recommendations that we developed through this project. Nigel already touched on a core part of this. Our number one recommendation was to align data privacy laws, and this starts with the U.S. standardizing its piecemeal collection of state laws into national legislation. We can't really align data privacy laws if we don't have a coherent one at home. So that's a great place to start. And then a lot of it is about shaping behavior within the digital system, or incentivizing digital values to align with liberal open values. One way to do that is greater engagement in digital through digital trade agreements, and really a bigger role of the US and other like-minded countries in shaping the emerging rules of the digital domain. There's a lot of interesting things going on with that now, the Digital Economy Partnership Agreement, which, you know, there's only three countries, Singapore, Chile, and New Zealand, but South Korea wants to join, Canada's expressed interest, and now China's trying to join. So it's really about having a seat at the table. And if the U.S. doesn't try to participate in these and China is, then China's going to be shaping those rules. And I mean, so the first step is just to not let that happen, to be at the table trying to shape these rules as they're formed.
Okay. Ali, any comment before we move on to the next question? Okay. What's the role of the private sector in all of this? Are the big U.S. tech firms, do they have a position on this? Can they be incentivized to help create this environment we want with free flow of data? Who wants to take that on? Yeah.
Most definitely. It's funny, right? Like I testified at the Senate 2 years ago, specifically on a topic that Adam in the chat posed a question about censorship as a non-tariff barrier. And it's funny, as a part of that testimony, I get the details of like who are the most prominent US companies that have managed to make it work and be in China. And in the last 2 years, we've seen a number of them exit with Airbnb and LinkedIn, and there being efforts to target GitHub and others. The number of firms that are really sort of in China and being very successful is growing increasingly short. But they also represent those firms, but also firms outside represent the dangers of China's model becoming the norm. And so you see more and more firms recognizing that this isn't just a China thing, even though China's a leader on these types of restrictive policies, that these are starting to permeate out, especially in India. But you also see it in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and you see notions of it in the African Union debate. And so they're stepping up their advocacy on it. But to what Doug was saying, like it's they're not finding much of a willing ear in the Biden administration at the moment, who has clearly not prioritized digital policy issues. In the prosecuting the USTR agenda, how it facets as a part of the Indo-Pacific economic framework is less than ideal, would be the diplomatic way to put it. And it's unclear how comprehensive and meaningful and legally binding ultimately, it will be. And so, the business community, I think, has really turned a corner in my time here working on China, in advocating, recognizing that they need to speak out and often speak out more publicly on it. But the administration, I mean, there's been no signal of what the Biden administration will ultimately do post the first agreement, US-China agreement, which didn't include much of anything on digital. And so it's just not a priority in that. And so we're just unclear really of like what exactly the US the Biden administration is prepared to do on digital. We've seen obviously good signs in the EU-US Trade and Technology Council, but beyond that, it's slim pickings.
Doug, you want to say something?
Sure, I'll just follow up on Nigel. I think a lot of this revolves around Nigel's comment of China's model becoming the norm, and that I'm basically getting back to my last answer of we need to be offering the alternative vision and strengthening and promoting that vision and enlarging it to incentivize companies that's the system that they need to be working within. So I, like you, Noor, worked at the American Chamber of Commerce for a number of years, and I saw this happening during that time, sort of 2016 to 19, where increasingly companies were needing to make a decision where their actions were going to offend either the US or China, and they sort of had to come down on one side or the other. And I think this is even more so in the digital realm. I mean, especially when you're looking at, like Nigel was just discussing, not being able to operate in the China market. But if you're still operating in a system, in a global system that China's influencing or controlling, that's not much different. So I guess the sort of liberal open system needs to compete more to be the dominant system, and that would incentivize companies to work within it. I don't think like the US government's going to incentivize US companies in the way that the Chinese government incentivizes Chinese companies. It needs to be more of a market decision with economic incentive.
I had a discussion with some people that know this topic pretty well last night, and they said for a politician to incentivize a company, it's usually the payback would be farther down the road, and the politician won't get credit for it. So it's hard to see that that's going to happen. Before we turn to audience questions, I have a kind of question on the physical infrastructure. So we talked about that. You did talk about that in this session. So China's actually, as the digital Silk Road, is laying fiber optic cable, creating satellites. So basically, they can run the data all on their systems and I guess keep it all in-house, for lack of a better term. Is that kind of what's going on? I don't know if those of us that don't pay attention to these things realize China is setting up their own physical systems around the world. Is that the case? Anybody want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, basically a key part of their infrastructure delivery is the infrastructure of the ICT environment, 5G networks, submarine cables, and increasingly data centers. And so you see that, I mean, as a part of the project, we mapped the data centers that Tencent Cloud and Ali Cloud are deploying around the world, and it's proliferating. And so they're doing that with state support, state financing, and they're pushing out because they're essentially trying to replicate what AWS and Google and others have got elsewhere around the world. And so what that means is that they're present in a growing number of markets. They're seizing market share from US and other providers there. But then also, the greater their presence, the greater they're likely to have an influence on the digital regulations which are put on top of that physical infrastructure. And that's what I try to highlight in my report, is that most of the attention about the Digital Silk Road and Belt and Road in general has been about hard infrastructure, but we're increasingly seeing that connectivity and that advocacy for the digital regulations that work on top. And that's I think, particularly concerning given just how fundamentally different China's approach is to the digital economy and free speech and human rights online.
Okay, a question about standards and standard setting. Again, I think this is an area where China's being quite active. Are people aware of this? Are they pushing back on it? You know, when actually Doug is said in AmCham, most people, American business people, were like, well, that's a government issue, you know, and I just want to get on with my business. But quite frankly, it's going to impact their business, you know, well into the future. So, but it was not a top concern, particularly the business community. So what's happening in that space? I know China's very active.
I'm happy to dive in, Doug. It's a funny, like, standard setting is such a weird and opaque space that doesn't get a lot of attention. And yet it increasingly is in focus with China's growing role there and growing attention there. And it's been interesting in that the main metric that most people use is participation and leadership of the various committees and stuff at the ITU and elsewhere, which is all fine and good, but that actually doesn't translate into influence. What matters are the quality of the proposals put forward and the ability to build a broad base of support for them. And thus far, we just haven't seen China really prosecute that there. And so there are safeguards there, and that's a key point, whether it's at the ITU as well as other standard-setting organisations, which gets to Jacob's point in the chat, is that it's about the governance, and it's about the US government not necessarily stepping in and taking a more direct role in setting standards, because the vast majority of standards are determined by private sector firms, but being aware of where standards are being set, in what environment, what's the governance arrangements, ensuring there's transparency, ensuring there's openness to participation, to ensure that there can't be any undue efforts by China marshalling its firms and other supporters to undermine the process to enact standards which preference Chinese technology or Chinese interests and Chinese policy preferences. And so that's the key part of the challenge. It's not so much the US government stepping in and seizing control of the organisation. It's about ensuring the governance arrangements built into these are followed and not undermined. But that doesn't get a lot of attention, and that requires coordination, which has not been really happening that much. And so I've heard from friends of mine that work in these spaces, it's that it's really hit and miss on whether the US government is paying the type of attention it needs to, and then considering how do we better support our stakeholders and being involved in these meetings to ensure that we have the good people in the room, to ensure they're fighting the good fight, and not letting sort of China flood the zone, as I said. And so that's tricky. Being involved in standards is an expensive and complicated process that only the largest firms can really be very good at. And it's something that even where, for example, US government officials are involved, that they don't get much support or recognition in doing. And so there's a need for the US government to sort of get its collective act together in this sort of tricky area.
Yeah, we just had a question from Jacob here. Can you see that about any thoughts on what the U.S. government tracking standards development should look like? I guess my first question, Nigel, might be, or Doug, but where in the U.S. government, who tracks standards? Who's kind of in charge of standards, particularly in this digital arena?
Yeah, I mean, it largely NIST, ANSI, and NIST and I suppose the Department of Commerce, they would yell at me if I didn't mention them first, are responsible for managing this. And I mean, it's not straightforward. There are so many standards development organizations beyond the ITU. And so it's really hard to keep a track of who's doing what in the proliferating range of new technologies that are under discussion. And so the Biden administration is doing a revision of its standards strategy at the moment, which is great, but whether it will be interesting to see where the details on that fall. The other thing I should flag is that it's great that more people are paying attention to standards. We've seen dozens of standards-related provisions in various pieces of legislation on the Hill, but unfortunately, not many of them are very good. And so we have a risk of the US reacting in the wrong way to standards and not reacting in a nuanced, sensible way, because a good standard system supports the US economy, the US tech sector, and other broader US interests. And so we don't want to we don't want to sort of kill that system. We want to do it carefully. But that requires some nuance that we just haven't seen the US government really figure out yet.
Okay, we're getting towards time, and here's a question I'd like to ask, and I think all of you might want to weigh in. And are we at the point of tech decoupling with China? Is it possible to cooperate with China in any areas in the digital sphere, or is that really off the table now? And whoever wants it, you've got the floor, right?
I mean, China's been decoupling from the global internet for 20 years now. With the Great Firewall, which we all know and don't love, but we've seen it reinforce its approach through major pieces of legislation in recent years, and we've seen a corresponding minor level of attention given to how would their system interact with the rest of the world. For example, China is trying to create digital special economic zones akin to what they did for manufacturing with special economic zones 20 years ago, thinking that a more liberalized little geographic zone for digital services is a pilot study for a stepping stone for them building greater connectivity of the global internet is just a bit, like, it's just not built for purpose. It's just not how the digital economy works, both domestically and internationally. And so I just don't see the path where China comes to the table in a meaningful way akin to what Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, Chile, the United States and others are moving towards in terms of putting in place a framework to support free data flows that specifically and narrowly target government-related legitimate concerns around data to support a sort of an open rules-based system. I mean, ultimately, it's still unclear whether China will be there at the end of the day at the WTA talks on e-commerce, because while talks have not gotten to the sensitive issue of data, eventually they will get there. And the United States has essentially made it a red line. And so it's unclear whether China will be there at the end. And so that would be another signal that China is set in its ways and not really meaningful in trying to build greater connectivity with the rest of the global internet.
Well, if you take dual circulation as a kind of your example, it kind of implies that China will have its own system, and then there'll be touch points where the rest of the world can connect to their system, or they can reach out to the rest of the world. Yeah.
I think that's exactly right, Nora. I was going to make a similar point that I think the dual circulation model itself kind of answers part of your question there. And, you know, NBR has done a number of other projects, has done some work in the past on the U.S.-China economic relationship more broadly than some of these tech issues. And we talked about partial decoupling. And so tech decoupling may be a component of the kind of broader relationship. I'm not going to be the first person to ever say this, but there are certain areas where I think the United States and China still do have benefits, mutual benefits and benefits to the world more broadly in finding areas for cooperation and collaboration. But there are a number of sensitive areas that the United States is better served in kind of continuing to move down the path of decoupling. So we're out of time to go into too many of those in detail, but I just wanted to throw that out there, and then if Doug has anything else to add.
Sure. I'm going to sort of come back to the same idea that I've been saying, but I don't think we need to actively pursue tech decoupling. As Nigel mentioned, China's initiated tech decoupling for a long time now, and that's fine. That's the world we're working within, but we don't need to do the same. What we need to do is strengthen and expand the system, the digital ecosystem that we support, the open liberal one, and create more buy-in for that internationally, which will then sort of weaken or negate the value of participation in the Chinese system. So yeah, I don't think we need to pursue that. If China keeps pursuing that, we need to shape the system so that it's not to their advantage to pursue that, minimize the value they derive from that while creating more incentive to participate in the existing or liberal open system.
Okay. Well, we are at time. There were a couple of questions that came in around censorship. I don't know if anyone wants to briefly address that before we close out.
Briefly touch on, because it's actually all of this was my idea stemming from Senate testimony I made a couple of years ago, in that the U.S. needs to U.S. digital trade policy needs to evolve to account for the many sort of different ways in which restrictions are applied, and censorship is obviously a major. It's used as a reason to block U.S. providers, U.S. content, U.S. services, U.S. connectivity, everything. And so this first step on what they're doing now, and there's a U.S. International Trade Commission inquiry underway that's doing the research and the advocacy, but basically it's an effort to try and help the U.S. government better understand the nature of the barriers facing U.S. firms in a nuanced way, in developing new trade provisions and cooperation to ensure that censorship in India or Indonesia or Nigeria or elsewhere doesn't just become another loophole that countries can use as another form of digital protectionism. But again, I've put my email in the chat. I do a lot of work on this stuff. Happy to talk with folks offline.
Great. Thank you for doing that. And I think someone may have mentioned something about self-censorship. And that's quite frankly an issue we all face when we do these programs with China.
My final point will be, you'll note that in the latest Top Gun Maverick, that the movie studios re-put the Taiwanese flag on Maverick's jacket because Tencent was initially a funder of the movie but bailed out because they thought that the Chinese government wouldn't like their involvement. And so the movie studios were like, well, okay, we can put it back on. And so that's an example of the type of challenges that US firms face, because under the current agreement, only 10 films, US films, are allowed in China a year. And so which ones get picked is a big deal.
Well, great. Well, time to wrap up. I don't know, Mon, did you have any closing comments, or shall I close it out?
No, I don't think so. I just put the links for our events, upcoming events, and also webinar recordings in the chat box. So to take a look, and I hope you can join us in the future.
Right. And I just say a really fascinating discussion, and one, of course, I don't think that most of us have given appropriate thought to, particularly our legislators. So again, thank you to the team at NBR, and thank you to our audience. I hope you've enjoyed today's presentation. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Yeah, thank you.
Crossings TV, Comcast 有线电视 Xfinity 152台为西雅图华人观众送上豪华中文电视节目大餐，东方新闻、凤凰卫视新闻、非诚勿扰一站到底，芝麻开门，每天还有精彩电视剧和更多资讯和娱乐节目，请记得收看 Crossings TV Comcast 有线电视 Xfinity 152台。查询详细节目信息，请访问 www.crossingstv.com。
餐饮、
娱乐、
招聘、
交友、
买房、
投资、
演出，
请找西雅图中文电台。
中文电台广告使您梦想成真，最低收费每月仅仅$100就有机会使您的生意或者活动家喻户晓。
赶快行动吧！广告热线206-619-8698，206-619-8698，
或者发 email 到 crsradio@gmail.com。
西雅图中文电台需要您的支持。如果您曾经听到过西雅图中文电台的节目，如果您曾经在西雅图中文电台网站或者微信平台上读到过我们的报道，如果您参加过中文电台举办的演出或者其他活动，请您支持我们。西雅图中文电台是由非营利组织西雅图华人广播协会支持的，大多数的主持人多年来义务为西雅图以及全球的华人提供精神食粮，请您向具有 501(c)(3) 免税资格的西雅图华人广播协会捐款，捐款的 PayPal 账号是scbaseattle@gmail.com， 捐款电话206-619-8698，206-619-8698。西雅图中文电台感谢您的支持。